This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
So, can you tell me what your name is?
I'm Ju.
Ju?
Yeah, Ju.
Hi, Ju. My name's Minnie. And can you ask your question for us, please?
What is a radio galaxy?
That's the big question I've been waiting for all day. I study radio galaxies. So you're familiar with what a galaxy is. When you think of a galaxy, you think of something pretty and spirally. I wish we had some examples. But, like, you think of something that looks like the Milky Way, or you think of something that looks like a ball of stars. And so that's what we see at optical light. It's what we're used to seeing. That's infrared. Yes, dear. But that's you're jumping my point. When you picture a galaxy, you picture it kind of in the optical, what our eyes are used to seeing, something like the Hubble telescope, those beautiful images. Radio galaxy is something that emits radiation at the radio part of the electromagnetic spectrum. So optical waves are like light waves that are about a couple of hundred to about 1,000 nanometers, right? And so really, really small waves. That's how our eyes can see lots and lots and lots of optical waves. Radio waves vary from about a millimeter to a few meters, right? This is why radio telescopes have to be so big. And these low energies probe a lot of things like star formation. We can probe the presence of black holes. We can probe very compact objects. We can probe diffuse emission in the universe. Radio emission probes all sorts of things in the universe. A radio galaxy is any galaxy that emits radio emission. And usually when we talk about radio galaxies, we're talking about the radio emission coming from a big black hole in the middle of a big elliptical galaxy. So we're talking black holes that are like 100 million times the mass of the sun, sitting in the middle of a galaxy, blasting out radio jets that are often hundreds of light years across, like hundreds of light years in diameter, really big plumes of emission. And that's what I call a radio galaxy. And I'm just going to give a plug here. If you're interested, you should go and Google Radio Galaxy Zoo, which is a citizen scientist project where we go ask citizen scientists like yourself to classify radio galaxies. Did you have any other questions, or was that clear?
I want to know, what do astronomers do all day?
Do you want me to answer that, or shall you?
We can go for it. I don't know about you, Minnie, but the first thing I do every morning is make a coffee.
It's a cup of tea.
Yeah. So, a day in your life, what would you say is...
A lot of it, there's very little actually staring through a telescope, unfortunately. On a good day, I might go to an observatory and use radio data, but most of the time, I am either doing maths, writing programs, or writing papers. So, most of my day is spent in front of a computer. It's a lot of fun, though.
It is a lot of fun, and yeah, it is very much a desk job, rather than sitting behind a telescope, I think. So when I get in, the first thing I do, I study pulsars. So
I'm sorry.
A lot of pulsar prejudice around. So the first thing I do when I get in, after I've made my coffee, is I look at what we observed with the Lovell telescope the night before, and I go through each of those observations and see if anything interesting has happened with any of those pulsars. Once I've done that, I get on with writing programs, reducing data, writing a paper. So a lot of it is just doing stuff on a computer with data that somebody else has already taken for us.
I do think one of the best parts of being an astronomer is we're doing what we love and hanging out with people we really enjoy hanging out with, talking about what we love. So a lot of science is very collaborative. I mean, I've kind of given you the dreary desk job side of things. I'm an observational astronomer, so I do actually spend a fair bit of time out of telescopes. And on those days, my life is just so great. If I'm observing an optical, I start my day by getting up, having dinner, because I'm observing at night. And then I go out, watch the sunset, and then I spend the night, you know, looking through a massive telescope. But that happens maybe a few nights a year, if that. So those are the really good nights. They're the days I look for, or the nights.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for being on our show.
So this question comes from Alexander.
When exactly will Halley's Comet be returning?
Thanks for that, Alexander. So, Comet Halley was last seen in the skies in 1986. I suspect that was well before Alexander was born. I was born, but I was too young. And in 1986, the viewing geometry wasn't exactly well set up for a good view of the comet because it was on the opposite side of the Sun to the Earth. So, Comet Halley is what's called a short-period comet, which means it has an orbital period of less than 200 years. Its orbit is highly elliptical, meaning that it's nowhere near a circle like you might expect for most planets. But in fact, it's more like an oval shape, or elliptical. The true mathematical term is an ellipse. Not only is it elliptical, but the Sun doesn't sit at the centre of the oval, of the ellipse. It sits closer to one end. The major axis, which is the distance along the long axis of the ellipse, is 35 times the distance from the Earth to the Sun, also called 35 astronomical units, or 35 AU. For context, this is less than the distance to Pluto. At perihelion, the point at which it's closest to the Sun, it's only 0.5 AU from the Sun, which means at its furthest point, it's still about 35 AU away from the Sun, which is a little bit more than the distance to Neptune. Now, we can use something called Kepler's third law to find out how long Halley takes to travel this path around the Sun. This law states that if we multiply the semi-major axis, that is half the long distance of the eclipse, by itself three times, we get a number that contains inside it the period of the orbit squared. Now, if we know the mass of the Sun and the strength of gravity, we can calculate that Halley takes around 75 years to travel around the Sun. And so if you were born at the right time, you might see Halley in your sky twice in your lifetime. Comet Halley will next reach its closest point to the Sun on the 28th of July, 2061, when I'll be 78 years old. Comet Hale-Bopp was the last great comet to grace the northern skies, but as far as I know, there's nothing that bright on its way into our skies at the minute. If you're lucky, Comet Tuttle-Jayakobini-Cresac, which I've probably massively mispronounced, may be a naked-eye comet early in 2017 until March. But for Halley, we've a while to wait yet.
This next question is from Asya.
How many astronomers are in space?
Well, generally, astronomers do not go into space. Six astronauts are on board the International Space Station this month, which is December 2016, and none of them are astronomers. The NASA astronaut who is in command has an advanced degree in operations research, which is a subject where people focus on using maths to make management decisions. The other NASA astronaut has a PhD in biochemistry. The three Russian astronauts and the ESA astronaut from France all have backgrounds as pilots, although they also have some engineering training as well. Generally, astronauts have to have university degrees in science, math, or engineering, and some astronauts also need piloting experience if they're going to actually be piloting the spacecraft, but they do not need to specialize in astronomy. The reason why is because most of the work that astronauts do in space is not actually astronomy-related. A lot of the work that astronauts do includes either piloting the spacecraft or performing mechanical work on the spacecraft. Many science experiments are also conducted in space, but these experiments include biological, chemical, and medical experiments that, for obvious reasons, do not necessarily require training in astronomy. The reason why many of these experiments are performed in space is often because the spacecraft are zero-gravity, or technically microgravity, environments, not because it is outside the Earth's atmosphere. Having said this, a small number of astronauts in the past have been astronomers. For example, Lauren Acton is a solar astronomer who flew on the space shuttle to perform observations of the Sun. And George Nelson was another solar astronomer who flew on the space shuttle to repair the Solar Max satellite, among other things he did on his three trips to space. In general, though, astronomers do not go into space, but instead send telescopes, planetary landers, and other types of spacecraft that they can operate remotely. This is mainly because it's technically easier to put a remote-controlled spacecraft into space and operate it for a few years, or even a few decades, than it is to put an astronomer up with the telescope and try to both operate the telescope and keep the astronomer alive in space for the same amount of time.